You know, I give a lot of presentations, and they vary. You know, when you're in a place like this full of marble and Galahad, you know, you tend not to do the come to Dewey, you know, speech. So this is going to be more very anti-American speech. I'm going to try and take a reasoned, long-term approach to the topic. And actually, I think this does follow on very well, because I would argue that reference, though I'm not actually going to address it too specifically, is in the midst of that revolution. And at the core of that revolution has been exactly this issue about what is reference without a desk. I would argue that libraries in general can look to reference as specifically as an example, because I'm going to ask the question about what is a library without these walls? What is a library without the physical books? What is a library without the collection? And some people, when you ask that question, may think that you have just defined what a library is not. And yet, these are what we're wrestling with. What I'd like to do is spend a little time dealing with the question of why. Why are we headed in some of the ways that we're headed? Why are people moving to different websites? I want to look at what's going on beyond it. Because the answer of the major revolution that we're in the midst of is, one, it's not the first one we've been in. It's not like the universe literally shifted when Tim Berners-Lee, you know, developed the web. Now, it's a good chance that CERN may literally shift the universe with their new super collider, but life changed. Life changes a lot. In North America, one could argue that the change that libraries are dealing with are just dramatic, because from 1940 until currently, the average age went from 40 to 78, a huge demographic shift. One can't argue that the notion of going from chained libraries to OpenStax was a minor change that libraries instantly accommodated. We wrestled with this. We thought this. And what I really want to take away is that libraries change, and libraries are constructed by people. I know that sounds like an obvious statement, but when I talk to a lot of people, there's always this bizarre sort of schizophrenic separation between us and the library. Well, why do you do this? Because that's what the library does. Don't you work at the library? Yes. Aren't you there for the library? Well, the structures that we set up, the services that we do, the move from the desk to a round desk to no desk and dead fish going down, which I just think is a great story, is ultimately and unfortunately a human decision and a human endeavor. So, long term, the way I want to address this issue is I want to start talking about evolution. I want to talk about two what I consider very major evolutions in terms of how we approach systems and in terms of how we approach the work of librarianship. And actually, I'm then going to talk about a third, which is how they fit together. So the first evolution that I'd like to talk about is a move from a system view to a user view. So we're going to talk a little bit about when we design systems, moving it from what it used to be to what it is today. And I also should clarify at this point, this is IFLA, I'm allowed to talk about epistemology and stuff at some point, right? That what I want to talk about when I say system, I mean that in a very global stance. This is a system. The idea of librarians on display. If you've noticed, people look in, they look up this, and then they look at the screen, then they run. This is an interesting system, right? Where you put the desk is a system. How you hold a conference is a system. An OPAC is a system. These are all systems. The other evolution that I want to talk about is a shift, an evolution from documents to conversations. That what we're seeing and what we're encountering right now with the mass electronic media is facilitating a much more interesting shift. One, if you wanted to take a really long view, could talk about going back to pre-literate societies in some way. I refuse to take really long views, but I'll do my best. So let's start with evolution number one. These two evolutions then match up into something that I want to talk about later, which is participatory librarianship, which is really these major shifts are changing how we approach and how we do librarianship. So, let's get going. Evolution number one. Let's look at the evolution from the idea of the system view to the user view. Now, I don't need all these intermediate stages. I want to talk about three major changes. The first view about how we design systems, once again, computer systems, physical systems, organizational systems, the first view that really predominated when we looked particularly in information science was what one could call the system view. Right? And this was the idea that we found the experts, we defined all our variables, we assigned how to be operationally efficient, we did all these wonderful studies, never talking to a user, but built the perfect system. Right? I can't tell you the number of times in the early web that someone would come up to me and said, you know, I've done it. I said, what's that? He said, I built the perfect website. You know, I said, oh, really? Congratulations. I said, yeah, they built the perfect one. It was exactly the way they needed it, and then they found it. Who's they? The administration, the people. Oh, the people who paid for it. Yeah, and they just screwed it right up. They worried about policy. They worried about this. This idea that we build systems for ourselves, first and foremost, is still really true. Come on, you have to admit you've hit a system where, you know, it's like with Microsoft Word, you have to think like a 13-year-old high on caffeine from Mountain Dew to truly understand what that stupid icon meant. Right? Batya Friedman at the University of Washington does a great series of research on what she calls value-based design. I may be screwing that up, but it's the idea that we instill our values into our software. Now, the next major movement, which really can be put to the late 70s and early 80s, was the user-based view, as purported by people like Mike Nyland and Brenda Durbin and lots of folks. And this was the saying, wait, if you're going to build a truly effective system, we should talk to users. Now, I don't want to say that people back here were just retrograde and stupid. The truth is that the way you talk to a computer back there was through punch cards, and how user-friendly can you make cha-chunk in hex? Right? And so now that users were getting direct access to systems, the notion of talking to the users and saying, what do you need? What do you want? Change things. I mean, it's very interesting that, we'll stick with that. So, user view. We need to talk to our users. We take that user view and we build our systems. Therefore, they will be better. Tends to be concentrated on the interface, but certainly can be functionality as well. I would argue that we're right now in the middle of a third evolution, which is really to the idea of user systems, that we need to begin dropping this concept of user-derived. These are where the user literally builds the systems around them, that we give them a little bit of functionality but let them play. Now, as I said, systems of broad view, if you look at our previous examples about these educational settings and these social settings, what we're saying is we unbolted the chairs and let people move them around. That's a user-built system. This idea of these rows and columns aren't working for me, I need to readjust it, we let them do it. The idea of letting them, whoever them is, our patrons, our clients, come in and build a system around it is a pretty significant difference. Let me look at some factors here. So, factor number one. In the first view, we look to experts to tell us how to do things. We didn't want anyone's view on how to build a system. We wanted the experts' view on how to build a system. And the idea is everyone else will be pulled up. We'll set the bar high and everyone else will pull up to that level and become experts themselves. In the second, user-derived. Now, user-based and user-derived, what's the difference? The users didn't build the systems. We interviewed and talked to them and then took that feedback and gave it to experts who actually built it. Andy Dillon, who's the dean of the University of Texas, got up in front of a group very bravely and said, user-based systems mean nothing now. And everyone, he said it in Syracuse, which is like sacrosanct. You're not allowed to say that. And he said, it doesn't mean anything because the truth is, you can find the group of users to tell you what you want. Right? It's like the idea of building library systems by getting those three people who come to the library every day, have read every book and know it better than you. Let's talk to them about how to get new users in. This is a dumb idea. They don't know. So user-based system was we talked to the users and we dealt with a lot of things about which users and how do we do it and what's the focus group. And this is the approach where we talk about users and non-users and all of this kind of thing. In the next one, it is literally user-built. Give them some functionality, go forth, let them fix it. I'll give you some examples in a second. In the first view, we had loaded with deep functionality. These systems can do amazing things. They take you and walk you through a very complex process. They do very complex things. They're very specialized, and frankly, there's still a place for them in our world. In the user-based system, also loaded with very deep functionality, but in user-built systems, loaded with very shallow functionality. So I'll give away the last column here and talk about things like Flickr and MySpace and Facebook and all these things. If you've ever looked at these social sites, they don't do a lot. They have lots of little, like, I have Facebook and I can now add flair to my site. I can put up little buttons. Right? This is not quite figuring out simulations of two galaxies colliding. Right? But there's lots of them. There's lots of itty-bitty ones. And the other thing is, it lets me decide how to put them together. So, from our Danish host, you know, Legos. Click, 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 whatever you want. Interfaces tend to be modal. What does modal mean? If you've ever walked through a wizard, you've been modal. It starts you with a function, you have to go from step 1 to step 2, step 3, and you can never get out of it until you hit step 8. That's a modal system. In user-based systems, we get non-modal. This was Apple. Woo, you can click here and go to this menu, and woo, it's crazy, right? And in fact, the user interface guidelines for things like the Apple operating system is never lock anyone into a process. Compare that to Microsoft that said, that's fine, but there's really complicated things that you have to do, like set up a wireless network, and we need to walk you through a wizard. So wizards are modal systems. In user-based systems, customizability. You want modal, non-modal, I don't care. The point is you pick it. And in MySpace, you can even make your background really ugly. Enjoy. But the point is you're making it and you're doing it. So, in the targeted view, we really had a targeted user. These systems were built for one type of user, for one type of event. In user-based design, we started talking about collaborative systems, systems that could communicate very easily. And in user systems, we tend to talk about social. It's very different than how we used to talk about collaborative systems. Collaborative systems is that you could email people files really easily and you could share files. Social systems are, we're all in it together at the same time. So, the integrated library system is a system view-oriented system. And with all due respect to all of my ILS fan colleagues out there, adding tags to a catalog is putting, in the States we say, lipstick on a pig. Right? The truth is, these systems are built for really targeted, specific things. You know who the ILSs are built for? You! Do you know how much you know compared to your users? A lot more. If you look at study after study about utility and finding and optimization, if you give someone a taxonomy and a classification system in the Library of Congress, you guys fly. You just cannot match your ability to manipulate those systems. You look at users, it's about the same as if you didn't do all that stuff and they just put in a keyword and hope for the best. Right? I've got an exam due on chemistry. I'll go to the thing and I'll search for chemistry. Right? User-based systems, operating systems are, if you look at the shape of operating systems from Vista to Mac, we love to think that this is Steve Jobs being brilliant in the back corner. And yet what's happening is they're doing an enormous amount of user evaluation, they're doing interface study, they're doing eye tracking. It's all about the user and how they look at things. And in the user-based systems, we're talking Web 2.0 kind of applications. Now what's interesting is this is not only a progression of how we think about system design, but it's also a progression of where the users tend to go. So if you look at things like, this is some statistics talking about the use of MySpace versus GeoCities from 04 to 2000. Let's see, what is this? This is a couple of months. This is GeoCities. This is MySpace. What's the difference? Or GeoCities, MySpace. What's the difference? They both allow personal creation of home pages and sharing of information. Wizard view, our templates, our functionality, wide open, create it, do whatever you want. You want a blog? Put it there. You want this? Put it there. How about Wikipedia versus Encarta? I'll let you decide which is which. This is not good enough. This is right. Everyone looks at this and says, oh, they just go there because it's good enough and people don't know quality information. Bull. The reason people are going here is because here they can control the experience. Well, we'll come to why they're going here. Right? They're both, well, this one's free. So is this one. Oh, well, this one, how many more letters did they have to type for the effort of going to one over the other? Something else is happening there. I'm going to just keep kicking this. Don't mind me. The question I want you to remember from this little exercise is, why do users migrate to social systems? This is where I want to get to, because here's the trick. I don't know if I started with this. Wikis and blogs are not the revolution. Wikipedia is not the revolution. They are a good first step and an indicator. They're canaries in the mine to say something else is going on here. So when people talk about how your library has to change radically and has to be new, the answer isn't you must blog. Because your question right back should be, why? why? What is it? What's value? What's causing this? Because it's not that someone looked at wikis and said, whoa, man, I've been waiting for years for that thing. Something else is happening. Let's talk about the second evolution before I come back to this question. The second evolution I talked about was the notion of documents to conversations. What do I mean by documents to conversations? So this is a little bit more long view. Think about the pre-web. You can talk about pre-internet, but pre-web libraries. And I mean literally from like 92 back until, you know, someone decided a scroll in Alexandria was a good idea to keep. The focus of the pre-web is on the document. It's on a document, right? It's, whether it's a book, whether it's an article, it's a document. The focus of a lot of what libraries do is a document. I was just at a conference and that library director said, you know, 80% of what we were doing was circulation, which is a document-centric view. We can talk about reference all we want, but really what we're getting down is that 5% of our activity. What's this 80%? Documents. What has happened in this nice little global view is that we have moved away from a document into not a document, a document-like object. Lorcan was here. We could have asked him what that meant. Right? But think about it. What happened when we shifted from a physical resource to an electronic resource, of which a web page is one example, is we moved fundamentally from documents to document-like objects. Now, what do I mean by document-like objects? And it's not my phrase, believe it or not. It's right in the Dublin Core. Traditional terminology becomes metaphoric. When you talk about a document now, what does that mean? When you talk about a book, I could show it to you. You could understand it was a book. What was a serial? A serial was not a book. Right? I once had a great question of a librarian. I said, what's the difference between a monograph, a book, and a treatise? And they said, what do you call it? But at least we could point to it, right? We could argue over it, but we could point to it. When you move to things like a web, you use the word document or you use the word collection. They're metaphors. They're not documents. They're ones and zeros that we've conveniently grouped into a file format. And with a web page, is it the web page or is it what the web page is connected to? And what do you call a dynamically generated web page? What the hell is that? Right? Though they're documents. It's a metaphor. It's not literal. And what you also see then is we began to apply prefixes. This is standard operating procedure. So now we have e-journals and e-books. And what's happening is we're getting this strong pressure. We desperately want to stay in a world of documents. We desperately have organized everything we do around a thing. And now we go, all right, it's electronic, but it's still a book. You know, it's an e-book. Right? And you're seeing this pressure and this tension. And eventually what happens, and is happening all around us right now, is that the document approach fails. And I want to show you two miserable failure examples of document-centric views. One called Cork, and one called NSDL, the National Science Digital Library. CORC, Collaborative Online Resource Catalog, was a brilliant idea that came out of OCLC, and they said, let's catalog the web. Every page, we're going to catalog the web. And if you really want to, put a MARC record in. Go for it. You know, and if that's too hard, put a Dublin Core and we'll crosswalk it for you. And it lasted about 3 months. Now, before you laugh too hard at OCLC, how many people here have URLs in your catalog? So you catalog the web. Now, the reason this is a miserable failure, I won't go into it too much, but it's just a numbers game. Google recently announced that they now estimate that there are 1 trillion pages on the web. They said, we don't index them all, but there are about 1 trillion pages on the web. 1 trillion pages? That's like a national debt in over here. If you had 1 trillion pages, it took you 1 minute to catalog every page, because that's an average, about an average. And we had the 65,000 members of the American Library Association, because God knows North America, we want to do it on its own without asking for help. It would take you approximately 15 billion minutes, or about 29 years, to catalog the web. That's if it stood still, you didn't eat, go to a committee meeting, go to the bathroom. So it's gone. Forget it. The document-centric approach to the web is dead. Google doesn't take a document-centric view. It just grabs content and builds a little bit of metadata, and it doesn't care whether it's a page or a book or a journal. It's text. I just index it. National Science Digital Library took a document-centric view, which is very emblematic of most of the digital library view. National Science Digital Library, it first came out, they said, we're going to build this wonderful library in the United States on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics education. And the way we're going to do it is we're going to give out a bunch of grants to collection builders. Their job is to build collections. We're going to give a bunch of money out to service builders. They're going to build services. So here is, you know, all these cool molecular models, the Confucian text, engineering textbooks. And over here is search and visualization and metadata creation, right? Makes perfect sense. And in the middle, enter magic here. We'll put the core integration service. And their job is to allow these services to act on these collections. Piece of cake. Because in libraries, we've always done this, right? We have technical services, which deals with the documents, and we have reference, which is like anything else, right? And in the middle is a manager going, how much is any of this cost to me, right? It failed, because what happened was, these folks put up their collections, but where do they put them? On the web. And you can't just put a collection on the web. You gotta, you know, be able to put an index so they can find the things. Well, indexes are all right. What we really need is a search box. Well, yeah, and what they started doing was they were building services, and when these services came to work on these collections, they didn't talk to each other, and no matter how hard the people tried here, they couldn't get it to work. The best they could do is, let's pull a Dublin Core record out of here, build our own search interface, which is half a good, and hope for the best. Sound familiar? Right? This is a failure of a collection of a document view. These are not documents. What the end result of this whole thing was is that the digital library is a collection of services, one of which is access. This was a major mind shift for us, which was the idea that when you put up search or when you put up anything, it's a service. Your website's a service. You say, but I got documents on there. I say, first of all, what's a document? But I say, all right, I got web pages. Leave me alone, Dave. I say, fine. Do you let people click on them? Yes. Did you put up a web server to get to it? Yes. Do you administer the web server? Yes. You're providing a service. You're providing a service that other people can. Interface is a service. Indexing is a service. Classification is a service on documents. It's not a collection. Your digital library is a service. So what we're finding is that this concept of the document-centered model is breaking down. Now, that doesn't even talk about how do you do a MARC record for Facebook? How do you do a MARC record for a Google search or a chat session? We laugh. We think that's hilarious because in our mind, we've made a separation between those aren't documents. Why? They're bits flowing over the Internet just like anything that has an HTML page. Right? What do you do with things like how effective is it to apply Library of Congress subject headings, LCSH, I missed that one, to a virtual reference transaction? You have a transcript from Question Point. Let's take a moment and classify it. Well, it's a 5-minute long process for a 2-minute long conversation. We don't do it. What about wikis, gigapixel images, where you're literally talking about the ability to take a picture of Boston and zoom in on a face in one document? What's the record look like for that? Well, that's easy. It's a collection record. It's just a picture here, click, Boston. How hard was that, Dave? And so useful. Right? So the question for you to remember from this little tale of evolution is, if not documents, then what? There must be nothing other than documents, right? It's like we're back to the idea of us versus them. God came down and made a library and said, there shall be documents. Right? What? Well, the what, we're actually already starting to see the what. So I want to give you a quick example. How many people here have been on the Website Sucks Committee? Sorry, this is the northern language. For those of you coming, I apologize for it. How many have been on the website redesign group, right? Our website's not quite right, needs to be prettier, needs to be better. Our OPAC's too hard, that's why no one's using it, right? let's take a look at exactly what's happening. So what I want to do is I want to talk about, in those conversations, how many times does Google or Amazon come up? It needs to be easier, it needs to be simpler, it needs to be shorter, it needs to be like Amazon. It needs to be like Google. Right? This is the same thing when Yahoo forced us to take every classification and turn into 13 hierarchical categories. Right? Well, what I want you to do is I went and I searched for Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, or the Philosopher's Stone, if you're from across the pond. And I said, all right, what do we got? So I went to the WorldCat. That's it. Now, that's the page dump, so you can't read it, I know, but that's the full page, so it's not like the first screen. Did the same thing with the Onondaga County Public Library, my home library, National Library of Australia, Library of Congress. Okay? Simpler, easier, better. We need it to be more like Amazon, right? Amazon. What's going on here? Oh, it's all marketing. It's all advertising. It's all that evil money stuff, yeah? That top itty-bitty little bar up there is navigation and branding. It's also the search box. Next little blue is the sales information. Who wrote it? What's the ISBN number? How much it costs? We get a little sales recommendation. If you like this, you'll also like that. We get then quality reviews. New York Times book review, Library Journal review, etc. This next little orange bar is bibliographic data. Now, what I want you to notice is if you add that bar plus the one you can't read that looks white, it's actually not too far off from these. So what else is going on here? You don't need more than bibliographic metadata to find something, right? Recommendations based on your previous purchases. You bought this, so therefore you'd also like these kinds of things. Open reviews. Open reviews. This is what people are talking about. They're conversations. People are talking about this book. But what's interesting is they're not actually talking about that book. If you've ever read Amazon reviews, it looks something like, this is a great book because she set up everything in book 5 and book 7. So which book is she talking about? Right? They're really trying to have a conversation about multiple items, but just like the OPACs, Amazon's forcing them around a document. Right? It's not natural. But just what's happening is we don't let them do it, because if we did, it might do that. Now, there's lots of reasons why they wouldn't, but Pathfinders. Remember when we did Pathfinders of things, if you like, magic and history. Additional information such as discussion tools. There's a wiki here, a blog, a video, etc. And then some marketing information at the bottom. So remember that question? If not documents, then what? Why are users migrating to these social systems? Why? Well, we've been working on that for about 2 years now, and what we've come up with is this concept called participatory librarianship. So let me just walk you through that really quickly, and I'll come back to those questions. What is participatory librarianship? Participatory librarianship is founded by on a theory called conversation from a fellow by the name of Gordon Pask, who says, he went to teach computers how to think, and he said, I'm going to learn from people until machines catch up. And he said, all right, when people go to learn, how do they do it? He said, well, what they do is they engage in conversation. People look at me really nasty when I say that, I think. But I got to be really clear what I mean by a conversation. Conversation has, first of all, two conversants in it. At least two, maybe more. Now, when I say that, you instantly think two people. But Gordon Pask, he was a wily one. He was a cybernetician, after all. He said, no, two cognitive agents. So that can be two people. We're really having, though it's one way, a conversation between you, the audience, and me. So a group can be a conversant. Right? Because I'm looking around for this or whatever. Right? That's part of the conversation. It can be when you negotiate with a vendor and you sit down and come down with a contract, vendor, organization, two conversants. But it goes the other way, too. You can have a conversation with yourself. In instructional theory, we call it metacognition or critical thinking. But it's the notion of saying, well, should I go out to lunch or should I wait here for 30 extra minutes? Who are you talking to? Yourself, right? So you have conversants, and then what happens is they're exchanging language. I won't go too much into it, but that's interesting stuff. And what are they doing? They're seeking agreement. Does that make sense? Is that right? It's a reference interview to a degree where you're constantly negotiating and you come up with these agreements and you can scaffold them to new agreements and then you store them in your memory. Now what's interesting is your memory is not done by alphabetically. It's relational. We relate ideas together. Right? So in the States, and I'm not sure how international this is, but in the States, if you ask someone what is the letter that comes just after the letter K, you will see them do this. A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J. They're singing to themselves because they've related that information. It doesn't have any other context, so they created a context for it. We add ideas together. All right? So, knowledge is created that way. We have our relational memory. We're engaging in conversation. When I'm reading a book, I'm engaging myself as I'm learning. Do I agree with this? Don't I agree with this? And if libraries are in the knowledge business, and I have very few people argue with me on that one, but you're welcome to. Therefore, they're in the conversation business. If libraries are in the knowledge business, and knowledge is created through conversation, libraries are in the conversation business. We facilitate conversations. That may be by adding materials to the conversation, but that's only a small part of it. Now, we'll go back to that in a second. This has a really interesting implication, which is people need to be active constructors of their knowledge. In other words, we used to have the bucket model to knowledge. This was the idea that you're all empty buckets, and I'm standing up here throwing bricks of knowledge out. And if I'm lucky, it goes in, it rattles around every so often. We've given that up. If you're not engaged in this conversation, if you don't care, you're not going to learn. You have to be actively engaged in this. We've revolted against just this format in our higher education system. Why we keep it here? I don't know. Because I like talking. We know that people need to get their hands dirty. They need to think about it. They need to argue. They need to go back and forth. They need to be in social groups. This creates a pressure to participate. They want tools that allow that conversation, that allow that participation. And that pressure goes on all of us. So what happens is, when people go to websites and they have a discussion and they can't find it on the website, they can now make their own website. If you've seen on the internet this phenomenon of the sucks.com, someone started going to Walmart, and they wanted something out of Walmart, and they felt mistreated. They went to get justice from Walmart. Walmart just threw, I don't care. So what did they do? They went and bought a domain called walmartsucks.com, and they put their complaints on the web, and it was indexed by Google, and suddenly people started going there and complaining about Walmart. And what this has done is create pressure on companies where if they have complaints, they want to host the forums, not to censor them, but at least to respond to them. And now they're coming in knocking on our doors at libraries. And they're saying, I want to actively engage in a conversation. You've got lots of materials and other reasons. Let's do it. They come to our catalogs, and what do? Give us a keyword, and we'll throw resources at you. It's not a conversation. The other thing that when you talk about reference, when you talk about facilitating conversations means more than access. A huge amount of what we've done, because we're in a document world, is we've defined one of our primary roles, if not the primary role, as access. So when someone comes in and they ask a question at the reference desk, we point them to things. Mr. Green said that we should walk them over to the shelf and leave them alone so as not to bias what they see. Access. But isn't that the buckets of knowledge? I mean, if you say, I have this question on chemistry, and I point you to a chemist, it's the old joke, if you ask the librarian the time, they give you a book on clocks. Right? This is not knowledge. This is not learning. This is not a conversation. Access is only one small part of it. Getting you in this room is only one part of knowledge, of a conversation. The others? Knowledge. How many people speak English as a second language? I raise my hand because I speak TCPIP first. Right? You are going to have a harder time with this than those who speak English as a first language. Maybe. Right? So you needed to learn the language. Right? When I went to China, I couldn't move in China because unlike everywhere else where an imperialist American shows up and expects English, China looks at me and says, you need to learn Chinese. And that really limited my ability to have conversations. Okay. What's the other ones? So we have access, we have knowledge, we have an environment. We need to create a safe environment where people feel they can converse. Right? How many of you have been in lectures like this where you've gone to ask a question and the response back is almost always, well, that is an interesting question. Of course, I've been doing this for 10 years and I know more than you and I have a PhD, so let's just not answer that one. Right? That's not creating an exactly conducive environment for conversation. when we walk around in this building and you see those enormous ceilings, which are gorgeous, this entire building screams, shut up. This entire building screams, we are a font of knowledge of which you are a visitor. These buildings are aspirational buildings. They are built because we believe that knowledge is the most important things within our communities, and so we build them as a temple. We forgot that when worshipers walk into a temple, they want to have that personal relationship, they want to ask questions, they're on a quest. And yet, we close them down. When we build reference desks, what are we saying? You have a reference question. Stop what you're doing. Leave your environment. Come to me on my terms. Ask me the question, and I will grant you the answer. It not only puts the users in a really precarious position, it puts the librarian in a tough spot. Because what's the assumption if you do all that work? That I know what I'm talking about. So when we look at, did you get an answer? That 55% rule? I got other data that shows it's even lower. Because what's the mismatch? Did we give them the wrong info? We define answer radically different from the people getting it. I gave them the book, and the person says, I wanted to know the time, right? So this pressure to participate is in here. How do we allow people to participate in our libraries? How do we... The fourth one, by the way, motivation. That we understand why they're asking us the question, and we recognize and embrace it. I mean, it's interesting. I think we all expect the thanks for helping me, and we feel really good when we get a compliment for answering a question. How many times have you complimented on a user on a really great question? Boy, that was a great job. Boy, you learned a lot today. You should be really proud of it. What? All right. So, answers to those questions. Why do users migrate to social systems? It's actually not for social reasons. I mean, yes, we all want social reasons, but there's something underlying it beyond vanity. And it's a very self-centered, selfish reason. We want to actively engage in conversations. We want to learn. Now, what's interesting is when we found that when you aggregate all these selfish acts, you get a social good. So when people upload images to Flickr for their own purposes to share and show off and tag it so they can find it, if you aggregate all those selfish acts together, you get something that's really interesting and useful for the group. People make the distinction between social media site and social networking site. OCLC did it because they were struggling with this. I make no such distinction. The media that they're sharing is part of the conversation. It's like me showing you a picture, right? The interesting part, I hope, of this lecture is not necessarily the pictures. I love people always ask me for the slides, and I give them the slides, and they realize these don't help because I have like 3 words on them, right? It's the conversation, and yet, what does the library do? We catalog that. This is the interesting part. This is what we're, I hope, this is what we're trying to facilitate. How many speakers come into your libraries? How many recordings do you have of those speakers that are available to show to the next person who comes in? How often do you capture the conversation and knowledge that's happening within your own community? How often do you look at the conversations that are happening? So everyone talks about the story. I'll take a little issue with the high point of my life as a reference work, because every librarian I've ever met has the story. You know the story. It's that thing that you pull off in your deepest, darkest hours when you're changing the toner cartridge again. And they can be simple stories. I really put this person, you know, it was a kid who came in and wanted a book. I gave him this great children's book. They were so happy. You should have seen his eyes. And they can be very profound. I had a woman come in and ask a question about where they could find a shelter for battered women, and I helped her get out of a bad marriage. They can be very lofty. I had a physics team that I worked with on a regular basis, and they made this major discovery. Whatever it is, when you think of those stories, how often do you then recollect the resource that was involved? I saw this person. They were pulling a book off that I just cataloged yesterday. That's not how we communicate. these artifacts, these edifices, these things, these documents, whether metaphoric or whether physical, are simply artifacts to the larger, more important question, which are conversations, which are learning, which are knowledge, which is the answer to the question about, if not documents, what? Conversations. Think about this in an academic setting. What is the thing Joan Beck in the 80s was telling us? What is the thing that we should be teaching in our instruction courses? Should we be teaching the catalog, or should we be teaching them about the necessities and truths of scholarly communication? Why is it when I come up for tenure, they ask for a list of books I do, but they don't want the titles of them, they want the citations to them? Because they want to know, did you have an impact? Did you increase and change and enhance the conversation of your domain? The laws that we set, the books and articles, the poems that we write are meant to inspire and enhance society, not be cataloged. It may be a necessary step, but let's not forget it. So how do you do that? Well, let's take the example. We have a reference librarian. We have a patron. We'll call him Bob. And Bob asks a question of a reference librarian. We'll call her Sven. It's international for him, Sven. Did it rain on June 18th in Yellowstone National Park, which is a pretty remote, pretty big spot? Now, this is not actually an easy question to answer all the time, because in many places in Yellowstone, there's not a weather report. There are not people. You can't ask the coyotes, did you get wet on the 18th? So this being a good reference librarian, we'll go and consult actually a meteorological simulation. And I'll say yes. Yes, it did. And Bob will come back and say, how sure are you? Because this is an interesting question. If you rained on your head, you have an answer for how sure you are. If you look it up on a page, how sure are you? Now, the answer to how sure you are in this case is actually you have to look at the underlying algorithm that built the simulation that made the estimate. There's actually a quantifiable answer to how sure you can be this happened. That simulation itself is fed with data from things like worldwide sensor nets, satellites, weather balloons. We still send up weather balloons on a regular basis. And it feeds all this data. But this simulation itself is the product of an ongoing conversation among a team of programmers and scientists and gatherers. What we've done is taken the question of how sure are you and linked it to terabyte and petabyte data sets, people, individuals, their functions, software that may not have a MARC record. Now, why did Bob want to care? Because Bob has to put this information into a filing he's doing in court. And it concerns an auto accident where the person is claiming it was wet and slippery, and therefore I did the accident. And he has to know, how can I prove that beyond his word? What I've just done is I've linked an auto accident in a legal case to petabyte data sets. This is a connection of a conversation. It's not the connection of a bunch of things. Well, this would go in legal research, and that would go in meteorological, and that would go in services, and that would... Why are we making those distinctions? Because those distinctions are document distinctions. They're thing distinctions. Books, materials. It took us 300 years to get books right. It's not like Gutenberg started out by putting an ISBN number in the Gutenberg Bible. Titles, page numbers, pagination, indexing, annotations, all of these took years and centuries to evolve. In the electronic world, we must evolve. We must understand that, first of all, the user is in control. The user is in control. And it's all about learning. If you catalog a book, if you put out the reference librarian, if you open on Sundays early, if you put wonderful things up here, it has to be about that user. Or else you're the user. And it has to be about learning. Why is this up here, by the way? To inspire. Right? This isn't up here because we didn't have any other places for it. It's supposed to come in. You're supposed to feel really important when you're here. Learning is a collaborative conversation. I've got to run through this really quickly again. Meaning that it's not just one person necessarily talking to themselves or a reference librarian. Why is it that a reference transaction is defined as a one-to-one relationship? Who said you can only have one reference librarian and one question? Why can't they invite their friends and their professors and experts into the same conversation and three other reference librarians at the same time? Library service facilitators. True facilitation means shared ownership. If you want to reach teens in a public library, how many teens do you have on your board? Why should they care about you if you don't give them control? And we must invest in tools for creation over tools of collection. Ultimately, we must evolve. Interesting. We must evolve. We are going to change radically again. We are going to encounter new problems again. We are going to invent whole new processes again. And we're going to get rid of functions again. Raghunathan's laws, one of them was the library continues to evolve. We must constantly change to new circumstances. We must evolve. And if you want any more information on this, and I just want to really clearly show that I'm into the evolving game as well, so here's me evolving. I had a little bit more hair when I started this. All right. More information about this in depth and demonstrations you can find there. I want to thank you for your time, and I want to make sure Stephen has an opportunity. Thank you.